I'm a technical evangelist for our Visual Studio application lifecycle management capabilities. If you made it to the keynote this morning, you saw a taste of what I'm going to be showing today. This session is really going to show you an overview of really almost everything that we're doing with respect to application lifecycle management within the Visual Studio 11 release. So you'll see a little bit of what I showed this morning, but where possible, I'll go a lot deeper and show you kind of what's behind some of the features that I showed off this morning. So I've been at Microsoft for almost 10 years. It'll be a couple months, and then that's my 10-year anniversary. So I'm in Redmond in Building 24. If you're ever there, stop by. I'll buy you lunch. I've said that to like several thousand people, so one of these days it's going to come back to bite me. I've been on Visual Studio almost that entire time. And I'm also on Channel 9. I blog all of my presentations, so I'll be uploading the presentations from this week to my blog. I also make available all of my virtual machines, my demo scripts. You can go through and use them as hands-on labs to learn for yourself or to take back to your team and show others. Currently on my blog, I have a Visual Studio 2010 virtual machine that has a lot of the new capabilities we ship there in the product. And then I also have a new one that shipped in conjunction with the developer preview that we released at Build, which is focused on Visual Studio 11. And I'm hard at work on updating that for the beta. So I expect that as soon as the beta is available, which is getting very, very, very close, I will be able to ship an updated version of this just a few days after that. So hope you enjoyed that. I've written a couple of books, and my publisher has not given me permission to say whether or not I'm working on the next version of the book. But we'll just leave it at that. And this is what we're talking about when we talk about the whole kind of end-to-end application lifecycle management. And before I dive in there, I actually just wanted to share a really special example of an application here that was built right here in the Netherlands, which extends Team Foundation Server. So my friend Renee here sent me an email about a week ago, and he said, hey, I just built this new product or this new Windows Phone application. It's called TFS Attacher. And so the history here is that about a year ago, I started working on an OData service to extend Team Foundation Server so that you could work with Team Foundation Server regardless of the platform that you're on. As long as you support HTTP, then you can start extending TFS in some interesting ways. And we've seen a lot of great applications there. And I really like this one. The idea is that that Renee, he's right here if he wants to stand up and kind of wave. So the idea was that if you're in a scrum room and you're kind of drawing something on the whiteboard, sometimes you just want to take a picture and upload that straight to TFS. So I would encourage you to check out TFS Attacher, or maybe you're talking to a customer or a user and you see an error on the screen and you want to take a picture. I think there's a lot of really nice use cases which makes it available to post it right into TFS. So there's a quick plug for Renee's application. So thanks for building that. Okay. So this slide is kind of the one slide that we use whenever we talk about Visual Studio 11 and what we've done in the product to facilitate application lifecycle management. And so we talk about these three different phases, right? Your definition of your application. This is where you're translating requirements, maybe from the IT department, maybe from end users, maybe new products that you want to come out with that you're not getting explicit products or requirements for, but you're identifying a need you can go serve. You're getting those somehow into the list of what it is that you're going to go out and build, and you're tracking those in something like a product backlog. I want to mention that we are using a lot of Scrum terminology here. We fully embrace Scrum, but if you're not using Scrum, everything I'm going to show you here today will work just fine regardless of the process you're using. So if you're practicing, Scrum or Waterfall or Water Scrum Fall, as I've seen it called in some places, then everything's going to work just fine. So just bear with me as I use some Scrum terminology just to simplify things. So you capture those into your product backlog, and then at some point you're going to start turning those ideas into code, and then at some point you're going to hand off that working software into operations, and everything just goes great, right? No problems anywhere in that life cycle. Well, we all know that's not true. Occasionally you have problems like misunderstood requirements. So we have this saying at Microsoft, how often have we built what our customers asked for, but not really what they wanted? And if you think about that, I mean, that happens all the time, right? I have misunderstandings with my girlfriend over very simple things that happen all the time, you know, let alone complex pieces of software where multiple people are coming together. You have needs of conflicting stakeholders that need to be sorted out. And so we really want to be able to solve that problem. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about the additional problems, and then we'll set up the solutions that we think we can provide with this release. Is everything okay? Okay, I need to fix something. Another problem. Okay?
Yep.
All right, thank you. So you sometimes have to deal with conflicting priorities, so how do you take care of that? And then once you start developing the code, as programmers, we tend to lose focus. You know, there's so many changes, and we want to be agile. We want to embrace those changes, but oftentimes you're in the middle of a hard coding problem, and then you've got to switch context, and by the time you come back, you forget what it is that you were working on. So we think there's some ways that we can extend the tooling to actually help you with that problem. And then unmet user expectations. So even if you did a really good job of fleshing out the requirements up front, by the time you hand that over to the user, there may need to be some course correction. So you saw me demonstrate the stakeholder feedback client this morning. I'm going to show you a little bit more of how that works. And then once you hand it over to the operations team, you've got problems like, hey, you know, we can't reproduce the problem you're having in production, can't reproduce that in our development and test environment, so we don't know how to fix it. Or you go back and forth with the development team and you ask for one set of diagnostics and you have to wait for them to send you this event log or some other set of files. So this is a similar problem to what we tried to solve with the 2010 release in terms of bridging the gap between development and testing, where the testers say, hey, I found a bug in the test environment. And as developers, we take a look at that and say, yep, you know, it works on my machine. Must be your problem, right? So one of the things we did there is we made it possible for you to run your tests, and as the testers are running their tests, they're capturing lots of rich information, whether that's a video recording, an event log, an IntelliTrace file, and then when they find those bugs, you as a developer can take a look at that and say, okay, I know what system they were running this on, I know which build they're using, and so on and so forth. Let me step through the IntelliTrace file to really understand exactly what's happening. Well, we want to do the same thing over in the operations world. The way that we approach that problem is a little bit differently, and I will show you what we've done there to make that happen. So that's about all I'm going to be spending in PowerPoint. I'm just going to use a couple more slides to set up the solutions that we have here. So this morning you saw me show off the storyboarding and the feedback tool, which again is really meant to make sure that we're extra crisp on those requirements up front. You know, the cheapest time to make changes to software is before you've actually written any code. And so to facilitate that, we have a great storyboarding tool now built on PowerPoint. And I promised to get out of PowerPoint, but now I'm going to show you a demo of PowerPoint, which is kind of ironic, but bear with me here. So this morning, and I forgot to warm up my project portal, so bear with me here. But this morning I showed you the TFS Agile dashboard and kind of the place where we store a lot of project artifacts related to doing product backlogs and sprint capacity plannings and things like that. Oftentimes you also want to have another project portal that you can just access and put documents on. So anytime you spin up your TFS server, we're going to set up by default an additional SharePoint library. And the SharePoint library is a really great place to put documents that stakeholders need to access, like a PowerPoint storyboarding deck. I apologize, on this virtual machine for some reason SharePoint's really slow, so we'll just have to wait for that to load. Just a great time for me to pour myself some water. Talk amongst yourselves. Hey, waterfall, yep, exactly. There we go, it's coming alive. Okay. Okay, so this is a storyboard that I built that really is meant to capture the web application that I have. And our web application is called Fabricam Fiber. It's an opportunity for us to connect with our customers and allow them to make changes to their telephone lines or say, hey, my cable's out. And so we really want to make sure we have a great application here. And so as we go about adding functionality, one of the things we want to do is get buy-off from other stakeholders to make sure that we're on the right track to meet those requirements. And stakeholders, we often think of stakeholders as being end users, and certainly end users are valid stakeholders, and we want to get their feedback as well. But a stakeholder could really be anybody, from a lawyer who needs to make sure that your site meets all the accessibility and privacy requirements, to maybe the CFO who's writing the check for the site, and you want to make sure that he or she has a good feeling about the direction that it's headed as well. And so here I have my PowerPoint storyboard. This, by the way, is something that I built in about 15 or 20 minutes. So it's something that's really easy to construct. And so if I come in here and, you can see you can model custom animations. And it really just gives you a nice framework to have a discussion. It's not super, technical. Anybody that knows PowerPoint can get right in here and start working with it, which is kind of the point. People ask me, well, what about expression sketch flow? What about using Visio for these? If you're using Visio and Sketchflow for doing storyboarding, great. We want to continue to make that possible so that you can do that. But oftentimes, I'm not a designer. I'm not good at opening up expression Sketchflow. I'm really good at PowerPoint, and I know that all the people that I work with on a daily basis that may be stakeholders in the application that I'm working on know how to use PowerPoint. They have it installed. And so we felt like that was a really great tool to help you solve this problem. And so we'll just create another storyboard pane so you can see how this comes alive. As it turns out, PowerPoint actually has some really great capabilities like layouts that make it really easy for you to do kind of master pages style inheritance from some templates. So here I have just a SharePoint template. And it's not just an image. These are rich shapes. So if I come in here and say Fabricam.com, I can edit parts of that. Or maybe I really want this to inherit the look and feel of the extranet site that I use, so I can switch that over. Now, oftentimes we're not actually developing in a vacuum. Sometimes we want to pull in some existing brownfield applications as well. So if I open up my customer portal here, I really got to warm up these websites. I apologize. Sometimes what we may want to do is just grab a screen capture of some existing functionality. So the storyboarding tab surfaces all that functionality for us. So I can just go over to screen clipping and say, give me this section, and we'll drop it in place. That color reminds me of Queen's Day. I was here last year on Queen's Day, which is fun. And then we can do something simple like add a button or add some other components. So we give you the storyboard shapes library, and the storyboard shapes library has everything you need to build web applications, Windows 8 applications, phone applications. So you can see I have a lot of really rich application controls that are in here. These are rich controls, so if I drag and drop a calendar in here, for example, you'll notice that these are all parts of the calendar control, so I can edit them independently if I needed to say, highlight instead of October 8th. I need to change that to a different date. So they're not just images. And we're going to give people the ability to extend these shapes as well. Whoops, I selected the wrong one. So we'll have a power tool that makes it easy for you to build custom shapes, and you can define the way that individual components within those shapes resize. And then we've got a community gallery that's coming, so you can share all sorts of shapes, whether it's Windows or Android or iOS. We don't care. We want to provide a great tool to facilitate those types of applications. And so we'll just do something simple. We'll add a button over here. We'll say create. Let's say that I wanted to make the kerning exactly the way my corporate standards were and change the font and change the color and everything else. I can do that and then save that back into my shapes library. And so I can say something like, where did it go? Oh, add to my shapes. There it is. This is a different build. I'm using multiple builds today. So this is a Fabricam button, for example, and we'll drag and drop it over here. And so that's something that I could then export and share with other people as well. So we have a common library of shapes that we can maintain over time. And then we'll grab, say, a mouse pointer, and we'll just model this as custom animation. So come down here, grab a custom path. So then that looks something like that. So, you know, really easy for you to model this, really easy for you to then turn around and share this with your stakeholders. You can also then link these back to the user stories in Team Foundation Server. So then you get that full end-to-end traceability that, that allows you to go back and do audits and say, you know, how is this project tracking and things like that. So once you've, you know, decided what it is that that you're going to be building and you've created an interim drop of that software, the next thing you may want to do, which I showed this morning, is request some feedback from your stakeholders. And this is really nice because we put the feedback at the control of the product owner or the business analyst or whoever plays the role on your team of deciding when a feature is done or at least done enough that you can start getting some feedback and some acceptance testing from your end users. And what I love about this is that everything, again, is then going to be stored and tracked in Team Foundation Server. So it's really easy for you to go back to the business later on and say, you know, you guys signed off on this, or you're the ones who told us to make this change, right? And so, for example, I can say, you know, I want to get feedback from Julia on our web application. And you can say something like, you know, open the main portal and sign in as yourself. And then you can say what you want feedback on. So I need feedback on whether the UI is customer ready. And you can give some more examples like, you know, are the logos right, privacy policy, etc. You need to add another feedback item and say the next thing I want you to check is do the workflows make sense, etc. And then once you're ready, this is going to send an email. You can also, as Julia, maybe you get a ton of these emails and you don't really want to deal with these coming in on a regular basis. So what you can also do is, as Julia, you can just go to the team web access portal and see all the list of the things that you've been asked to give feedback on and then just sit down and give feedback in one chunk. But by default, we assume that Julia might like an email. And so we can send this email. And I actually have one that's already staged here. So let me open that up. And then Julia is going to get this email, which looks something like this. And it's going to say, if you don't already have the feedback client installed, click here to install it. And that'll download from Microsoft.com. And then Julia will have that running on her system. And then once she's ready, she can say, start her feedback session. And this is going to launch the feedback session with all those parameters that I fed in earlier. And so this is going to include special instructions for where to access the build, how to install the application, or how to access the URL if it's just a web application. And then once we're ready and she says, okay, I'm at the page that I'm going to give feedback on, then it's just a matter of her saying next. Notice here that you can capture screen with voice, screen only, voice recording. You know, this is not a substitute. Like I said this morning, it's not a substitute for actually being in the room as Julia's using the application and kind of watching over her shoulder and getting a sense for what she's struggling with. But it's the next best thing. So when that's not possible or just doesn't scale, this is a great way for you to really understand how your users are struggling with the application. We've all been there. We've gotten that one-line email that says, hey, I'm having problems on this particular page, and that's just not good enough. What if we had a video recording or an audio annotation where Julia is screaming at the application and cursing, you know, the problems that she's having? That's the type of feedback that you can act on back in the development team and say, hey, we really have to fix this because Julia is our most important end user, and if she can't figure it out, then no one else is going to be able to. So she can go through this application and, you know, let's assume I'm capturing video or whatever I want to capture here. New UI looks pretty good. And then she says, if I go into the dashboard here and, you know, maybe pick one of these records and I go to edit, you know, I notice here that I can't actually edit who this is assigned to. So, you know, would love to edit assignments here, and so she can grab a screenshot. It just makes it really easy for her to just quickly get in, give the feedback, and then get out. And so when she says next, this is asking about the customer workflow, so she could come back here and, you know, spend some time making sure that the workflows make sense, and maybe she says, yep, that's great. Says next, gets a chance to review any of this feedback, edit the feedback if she needs to, and then once she's done, she can submit, and she's back to whatever it is that she needs to work on. And so you as a product owner then, if you return to this dashboard and I refresh that, you'll notice that this actually changed to some additional feedback requests. So if I go back to the feedback manager here, I can take a look and I can see all the feedback I've got across all my users. And what's nice about this is that we're using the hierarchical work item relationships here within Team Foundation Server. So a feedback response is linked to a feedback request, which is then possibly linked to a user story. So it makes it really easy for you to get in and look across the entire system and understand exactly how things are progressing across the system. Okay, so that's the feedback client and storyboarding. Any questions before I go on to the next stanza here? No? Okay. And if you do have questions along the way, feel free to interrupt me, shout out. I certainly don't mind. That's great. So we've decided what it is that we think the users want. The next thing we need to figure out is how we're actually going to make that happen. We need to flesh out those implementation details. We need to start scheduling some of this work. We then need to figure out through the course of our day-to-day lives as programmers, what is it that I need to focus on right now? And so the next stanza here, I'm going to show you some of the tools that we've done to really surface this and make it a lot easier. I am going to switch to the developer preview build, which is about 6 or 7 months old now at this point. And so I would strongly encourage you to check out the beta. We've done a lot of finish work. So once that's available, I wish I could show it this week. We're really, really very close, so it's a near miss. But bear with me here. I think you'll get the idea of where we're headed here. It looks really good in the preview. So this is the developer preview. Before I launch into Visual Studio, let me spend a little bit more time focusing on what I showed earlier around web access. And that actually, for that one, I am going to show you the beta. I'm not really allowed to do this, but that's okay. They can fire me if they want to. So the beta UI, as you can see from the last one I just showed you, it looks a lot better. So you can see your burn down here. You can see all your feedback. These are actually team favorites, so you can drag and drop things like builds on here, and so you can see all your builds right here from the UI. We now even allow you to queue up a build straight from the UI, so you can just kick off a new continuous integration build. I'll show that in my talk tomorrow. But if I look at my backlog, you'll notice, first of all, that this is my team. So I've defined it what my working group within Team Foundation Server is. You know, at Microsoft, we've got maybe 1,500 people that use a single instance of TFS for doing everything from Visual Studio to .NET Framework to the Expression tooling and Lightswitch and so on. Well, I don't work with all 1,500 people every day. I work with my feature crew, my working group of people that are on my hallway. And so we now give you the ability to create these individual teams within TFS that then, you know, allow you to have a common backlog and a common set of sprints and iterations that you manage. And so when I click on this backlog, this is my backlog, but there could be lots of other backlogs across the product as well. And so you saw me earlier come in here and say something like, you know, make sure Scott gets his red polo or whatever the requirement is, and we're going to drag that up and make that really, really important, and we'll give it some user story points, and then we can assign estimates to these as well. So these are just kind of ballpark estimates. If you've done Scrum style estimation, we haven't yet broken down the work, but we kind of use, you know, t-shirt sizes or rough orders of magnitude to say how much work do we think is going to go into this product backlog item. And that allows you to have a conversation with your users or your stakeholders about when that particular feature might show up based on your team's velocity. And so if I click on this velocity chart up here, you can see the historical velocity for the last couple of iterations. And so we sometimes refer to this as yesterday's weather. It doesn't necessarily mean what we can do in tomorrow's sprint, but it does give us a ballpark indication of how much work we expect we might be able to get done. And so now what we've done is we've given you these forecast lines. And so we can say if we have a velocity of about 10, this is how much work we can get done. And this is when work is going to show up in specific iterations. And if we bump that up, you know, and start buying extra caffeine and beer for the team, you can see, well, maybe beer has a negative effect, I don't know. But caffeine certainly can drive our productivity up. It makes it really easy to give that estimation. And so now I can take this work and say, all right, it's on our product backlog. Let's go ahead and schedule it for sprint 3. And you'll notice that it actually scheduled right away. So these are getting written to Team Foundation Server immediately. There's no kind of, you know, published process that goes on there. So we can quickly iterate on this. And now that we know that this is work that we want to do, we can then break this down. So this morning I said, pick up the shirt from the dry cleaners. And we'll assign that to Annie this time. I don't know why it takes her 4 hours. Dry cleaners is like way out there. We can do something else, you know. Iron Scott's shirt. And so then once we've broken down this work, this is going to have an immediate impact on our sprint. And so this is a mid-flight sprint, so you can see I have a bunch of work that's kind of in progress, and people are working on a variety of tasks. And you can see over here on the right-hand side that our capacity is now maxed out for people like Brian, and Annie is actually over capacity at this point. And so we have a few ways of dealing with that. We can either assign work to different people, like maybe somebody who has some spare capacity, like Peter, we can assign the work to him, or we could punt other work from the current iteration into some future iteration. And that's usually what I do here is just take like a user story down here that hasn't been started yet and move that over to Sprint 4, and then everything updates in real time. So another point here for those of you that use Team Foundation Server today, you know, we ship with a ton of really great reports out of the box, and all those reports kind of update in the background using SQL Server reporting services. Well, here we're actually using an operational store for things like the burn down and these capacity charts. So those update real time right within the web application. So that's kind of nice. Now, you may be wondering where some of these capacity numbers are coming from. The capacity is actually dictated by you based on the number of hours that an individual is going to work on your project per day. So earlier I mentioned that you can have multiple teams. Well, as a team member, you can also be a member of multiple teams as well. So maybe you share a designer with three other teams, and that designer is only able to work on your project about, you know, an hour a day. You can come in here and you can model that, and that's where we get all the information that helps us show you that capacity. Additionally, if you know someone got sick or needed to go on vacation, it's really easy for you to come in here and model those vacation days or team holidays or something along those lines. And you can also go into the XML behind the scenes and you can define what your work days are. So I've talked to customers in some countries that you know, their work week maybe doesn't start on a Monday, and so they need to go have that flexibility of changing when their work weeks are. So you can certainly do that. We give you all those capabilities. And again, all of this works regardless of what process template you're using. If you're using Scrum or CMMI, all of those are going to work just fine, or a custom process template. So then once I decide what work I'm going to work on, then I can start dragging and dropping this work over to the individual columns. And so you know, this is probably what a lot of you have seen or used in the past, where you have sticky notes on a whiteboard. Works really well, except when you have people that maybe aren't at your location or maybe are checking in on the weekend to say, hey, where are those sticky notes? I've seen teams set up cameras on the whiteboard, and you know, I guess that's a solution, but it's not always the best one. And so this is the modern equivalent of sticky notes. The other funny story, I was talking to a customer, and they had sticky notes on the whiteboard, and one of the guys was there working late, and the janitors came in, and the janitor goes over to the whiteboard, and they see all these sticky notes on the ground that had just fallen off, and the guy starts picking up sticky notes and putting them back on the board. And he says, you know, how do you know where they go? And the janitor's like, oh, I don't know, wherever there's space. So I can just imagine the poor developers coming in the next day saying, I know I did that, you know. So maybe not the best solution, but this one I think is a lot better. The other thing that we've done in the newer builds here is we've touch optimized this as well. So as Annie, there's a couple of ways to change the amount of work that's remaining. So maybe she's halfway to the dry cleaners and she's on her way back, so she wants to say that she earns 2 hours. Well, one way is to double click on the work item, and you can come in here and make additional adjustments as needed. Or if I was on a touchscreen monitor, I could just touch this and then select 2, and then I'm off and running. So that's really nice, especially if you have a touchscreen monitor within a team room. I've seen a lot of teams at Microsoft start to set those up. And that way, you know, you're on your way to the break room. You say, oh, I just finished that, or oh, I just did a few hours of work against that. You just tap it, you know, update it, and go. So it's really nice to be able to fit that right into the culture, as opposed to saying, hey, you need to go into this separate time tracking tool and, you know, drill 3 levels down to this project and make that update. Does that also work for the owner of the work item? It should. Let me see if it works in this build. Yes, it does. So you can tap and say, I know that Brian's out today. I'm going to pick up this work. Great question. And so then I can take this work, and as I'm dragging and dropping it over, then it's actually updating my burn down up here as well. So you can see where the burn down's at right now, and we'll take some more of this work and just burn that down. And pretty soon my project's looking pretty good. Okay. So I think that's all I wanted to show you in that build. Yeah, question?
When you're adjusting the time remaining, does it actually count time away spent?
When you're adjusting the time remaining, does it actually count the time already spent? And yes. So I think your question was, how does the burn down get modeled? Yeah, so we're actually taking constant points in time every day for this burn down. So if you had, let's say you just had one task you were working on and that task had 10 hours. Well, on the first day of your project, it would say 10 hours. Then let's say you started getting into it and you say, oh my gosh, this code is, you know, spaghetti code. It's going to take me 12 hours. You change it to 12, then that's just going to move up on the trend line. And then vice versa, as you start to burn that down, it's just going to move down on daily increments. Now, all the history is stored in Team Foundation Server anytime you make a change. So if you need to get in there and understand exactly on a finer, you know, basis who made what changes, and when, and throughout the course of a day, how are you trending? All that data is there. You can report against it. You can party on and answer any of those sorts of questions. But what we find is, you know, most of the time, especially on smaller teams, you really just want to track at this granularity, which is, hey, show me, you know, roughly how many hours we have to get this done. The other thing, actually, that you can do here is you can pivot by individual. So I can say, you know, show me all of my work. And this is really nice to say, you know, just show me my view. And then the other thing I can do is switch to a team member's view. And so we can walk into our daily stand-ups and we can go around the room and say, you know, who has work that's remaining? What did you do yesterday? What are your impediments? You know, you can answer all those sorts of questions and quickly see exactly who's working on what. And the nice thing is, because this is just a web browser, you know, I can just kind of scale that up and down, and I put this on a really big monitor and, you know, display lots of information there. Additionally, if you had a process template that had custom workflows in here or additional workflows, then you would just see those light up as additional workflows, and you can go into the XML and make those adjustments to say, what do you want to show up on this particular screen? Yeah?
Do you get feedback on whether your estimations were, your starting estimations were right or wrong?
Yeah, great question. So he asked whether or not you get feedback on whether your starting estimations were right and wrong. Not on this view, you don't, but there are plenty of reports in Team Foundation Server that can answer that question for you. There's one that I kind of refer to as the dark matter report. It shows it's kind of work scope over time. So it's work that always existed in the system, but you didn't know about it until you got into actually working on that project. And that can be really helpful as well if you historically on a particular project notice that your work is always creeping by 30%, then next time you go to, you know, make a bid on how much time it's going to take you to do that project, then you can say, well, given the complexity of the code base or the outdated technologies we're using here, we should pad our hours by an additional 30% so we're not burning out the team. So yeah, there's a lot of great reports in there. There's a book called Software Engineering with Visual Studio Team System by Sam Guggenheimer, which was written a few years ago, but a lot of those reports are still valid and they're very relevant. I haven't had a chance to review his latest book, but I think he has a lot of those reports in there as well. So yeah, great question. Yeah. I'm sorry, start over.
There are 3 states: to do, in progress, and done.
Yeah. Yeah, you could certainly do that. You could create, and this is in the XML. I'm not going to dive into the XML right now and bore everybody with that, but it's all documented. You can say exactly which process states you want to represent here. So by default, the process that we use for a task in the Scrum template is just to do, in progress, and done. Now, you could add another workflow state that said to do, in progress, and change it to done but not tested, and then done, right? You could change that if you wanted to. And you could have that either represented just in the work item itself to make that an option that you could switch on and off within Visual Studio. And then you get the added option of saying whether or not you want to represent that on the task board. So sometimes, especially with, you know, the CMMI process template, you would have like 12 different columns for some of the workflows in here. And so we just model the ones that we think make the most sense. But if there's ones that are important for you to turn on, you can certainly go in there and do that. Does that answer the question? Great.
Is it possible to make a difference in the color of the work items on
the board? Yeah. Yeah, so we've had a lot of requests for colorization of some of these work items. I don't know if we're going to make that into the final version of what we ship this year, but certainly we have a lot of requests for that, and I think that that's something we'll consider. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, can the reports be used for timesheet management? And yes, you can use a lot of the reports that are in Team Foundation Server to start getting time estimation. There's also some additional add-ons that plug into Team Foundation Server that allow you to do timesheeting separately and kind of go above and beyond what you would get out of the box with TFS. Sometimes you don't want to, you know, accidentally enter the wrong value into TFS and accidentally bill a customer for 10 hours when you meant 1 hour. So some of those additional timesheeting capabilities make it easier for you to kind of roll up that data and refine it over time. I don't really have any recommendations along those lines, but if you send me an email, I'll send you a list of the ones I'm aware of and maybe find one that works well for you.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you also customize those views so that you, for example, not only show now team members, but also, say, teams or categories so that you can...
Yeah, so his question is, you know, in addition to being able to show team members here, can you also show teams and categories and that sort of thing? You can't do that from the task board view, but you can have multiple task boards that model that. So, for example, you know, maybe I participate in two different teams, and on one of the teams I'm responsible for the back-end database schema, and another team all we do is web UI. There, what you would do is you would have effectively two different teams that you would model within TFS. They can have the same team members, but you could say, here's the project that we track to model all the changes to the schema, and we map that to what's called an area path within TFS, and then this is the one where we do the web UI. And so basically what you see here from a backlog and task board and capacity backlog perspective is a combination of a set of iterations and an area path and the people that make that work. And so if you wanted to then create another team that had the same list of people, you could basically achieve what you're asking, but not on this view. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry?
Can you still use the current process template, or do you need to create a new one?
Yeah, so the question is, can you use the current process template from, say, TFS 2010, or do you need to create a new one? Yes, you can use your current process templates. I know that there was a lot of pain moving from TFS 2005 and 2008 to 2010, and the team's done a lot of great work there to make it a lot easier for you to upgrade to TFS 11. We're working on some screencasts and some additional guidance that we'll make available soon that will show you how to get onto the TFS 11 beta. But they basically have some commands you can run against an existing process template and add the additional work item types you need to take advantage of some of these features. So, for example, if I go back to home here and if I take a look at the request feedback tab, this, when you request this feedback, it creates what's called a feedback request work item, and there's another work item called feedback response. And so what you would do is you would go through a process where you're upgrading your existing process template to add those fields. Optionally, you don't have to, but you would add those fields, and then it would take advantage of that. Same thing for working with things like the product backlog. You need to tell us what query represents the product backlog or whatever the equivalent is in your process template. Same thing with the task board. What do you want to model there? So yes, we have some guidance there, and it's still getting developed, so we would love your feedback. But from what I've seen, I think it's going to help most customers easily get to 11. Good question. Is the template editor available? So he's referring to a power tool that we ship that allows you to graphically edit the process template in TFS 2010 and previous versions. It's not going to be available on day one of the beta, but I know the team's working on it, and I think it'll be available shortly thereafter. So I don't know what their schedule is. Yeah. Anything else? I thought I saw a hand over here. No? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, will the third-party process templates be supported? We would like them to be. That's a question for the third parties. You know, you could always take their process templates and you could pretend that's your own custom process template and add the additional fields. But really, if you have a question about a specific process template, I would direct you at them to see if they're going to do that work for you. I know in the past, Conchango, for example, they had the first Scrum process template, and they did a lot of work to provide upgrade and migration support over to the newer versions, but I don't know the specifics of any of the other third parties. You use Conchango. Okay. Yeah, I would say ask them, and when you find out, let me know. That would be a good question for me to know. Okay. So that's enough of the dashboards. Let me show you Visual Studio. It's funny to do a talk on Visual Studio application lifecycle management and spend all this time in other tools, but I think it's really important to kind of showcase how, you know, it's more than just writing code. Sometimes it's about getting that feedback and making sure you're building the right thing. So what I'm going to show you now is a demonstration we showed at the Build conference, which is you're in the middle of a set of edits. Maybe you're implementing a feature or you're fixing a bug, and your manager comes into your office and says, hey, we've got this other high priority bug you need to work on. And, you know, that's all fine and good. You can switch over, but you know that in so doing, you're going to lose all those file edits, all those open, you know, tabs that you had. Here you can see I've set some breakpoints. If I had multiple monitors, maybe I've got different tool windows from across Visual Studio open on multiple monitors. And that's a lot of time that you have to spend every time you switch context. And so what we've done is now we've implemented a redesigned, or to use the Windows terminology, a reimagined, gotta love that one, a reimagined Team Explorer. And so with Team Explorer over here, you can see we have this concept of what's called My Work. So we have a much more streamlined design over here. And My Work allows me to come in here and say, you know, this project that I'm working on right now, let's go ahead and suspend that work. And so, you know, I was in the middle of designing an implementation for a feature. It knows that because there's a work item that I was working on, and I told TFS I'm going to work on this implementation of a feature. And so I can say suspend now, and it's going to save all these changes as a shelf set to Team Foundation Server, and it's going to take place of all those open files, those breakpoints, and so on and so forth, so that once I go off and I finish that bug, I can come back here, and so let me just clean up my workspace. I'll delete all those breakpoints. And then once I'm done, I can come back to my work. And you'll notice that I have some work that's suspended. Now I can just say resume. It's going to take that shelf set from the server and unshelve that back onto my system. And it's going to open up the state of all those tabs, all those breakpoints, and I'm good to go. So I'm off and running again. So we hope that this is going to save you a lot of time as you're trying to context switch. We still haven't come up with a solution for preventing your boss from bugging you in the first place. But maybe by Visual Studio 2030, we'll get that one right. So at this point, I can go ahead and, you know, check in these changes. And this is the new pending changes check-in. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time showing you this because it's changed dramatically in the beta. But the idea is that we've made it a lot easier to do check-ins. A lot of the times in the past, you would get these constant nag messages anytime we thought there was a merge collection or merge collision. We've done a lot of work behind the scenes to reduce the number of those messages again so that it makes it a lot easier for you to check code into TFS. The other thing that we can do here is how many people have tried working offline with Team Foundation Server? Yeah, I apologize. It's kind of a pain, right? So if you use TFS 2010 or earlier to go offline, you have to explicitly go in and tell TFS that you're working offline using a command line prompt. And then what that does is it marks the files so that we can remember which files you might be working offline with. It's just a big mess. The other thing that is if you try to use like a third-party tool to edit some files, like let's say I just want to drop into my web config, I have it on disk, and I want to make some quick changes. So you open up the file, it's in your workspace folder, and you make a change, and it says, actually, this file is read-only, so you got to go back to Visual Studio and check it out. So it's a pain. So what we've done now is we've implemented what are called local workspaces. And local workspaces now allow me to just come into whatever I might be working on, and let's say I just want to make that change to the README. Hi, Netherlands, make that save. You may have noticed in the pending changes over here, we actually just detected that in the background. And so it's just running in the background saying, hey, you just made this change. If I come in here and maybe delete a file, so I just deleted a file, it shows up down here called in a section called detected changes. So by default, you're not going to accidentally add a bunch of files or delete a bunch of files and then go into Visual Studio and check them in. We want to make that a little bit more explicit. And so you can say, actually, I did not want to check that in. That was an accidental deletion on my part. But this other file over here, I did want to check in. And so you can go ahead and make that change. The other cool thing about this is that Team Explorer Everywhere, which is our TFS client for Eclipse, Team Explorer Everywhere also supports this capability as well. So I get a lot of questions from people that are doing Xcode development, and they say, hey, we would love to work with TFS. We would love to build a provider for Xcode, but unfortunately the extensibility is not there to support TFS. And so what you can do now is you can be running Team Explorer Everywhere in Eclipse in one window, and then you can go make your changes in Xcode or Photoshop or whatever you need to on disk, and then periodically you can go over to Team Explorer Everywhere, look at the list of files that have changed, and then check those in. So it provides you with a really nice experience there. Even though it's not natively built in, I know a lot of people that have started working that way, and it works great. Okay, so the other thing I want to show you here is we now have work item searches built right in. So that was a big feature a lot of people asked about. So my boss was asking me about working on this particular work item, because Julia's out today. So it has something to do with fixing Canadian addresses. So I'm going to assign that to myself. I'll go back to my work. And there I see that new work. I'll go ahead and say add this to in progress. And that way I don't forget to associate the changes that I'm going to check in later on. And then we'll go into wherever I need to make that fix, if I can remember where it's at. There it is. So it's always great when your fix is just a matter of uncommenting some stuff. Don't you love that? And so, I just changed this regular expression to support Canadian postal codes. But before I actually check this in, I would love to request a review. And I saw that there's a wildcard session that's added tomorrow, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the code review here. You'll get a lot more details in tomorrow's session, specifically around code review. But I just wanted to give you a quick taste of what this is. I can say add this to an individual or multiple people if I want to. I can provide some additional context. So, is my regex right? And then at this point, I can go ahead and submit those changes. And so this is going to send it over to Cameron, and Cameron's going to open up his Visual Studio. And when he does that, he'll be able to drop into my work. Now, there's an important thing here, which is I'm not bugging Cameron. I'm not having to go into his office and say, hey, I'm ready to check this code in. We really want to make it something that he can do when he has the time, as opposed to disrupting his context and making him switch all over the place. And so now if he goes into his my work and he looks at that request, then he can see the file that I've asked him to work on. And he can accept that code review request, which asynchronously then tells TFS that he's working on it. So if I wanted to check the status, I can see who's working on my code review request, which is nice. And then he can come in here, and this is actually the inline diff editor, which is newer in the beta, but it's effectively the same thing, which is I can do things like look side by side and easily see the files that have changed, and I can scroll these up and down. So that makes it nice. I think it's the first time in like 10 years we've changed the diff tool in Visual Studio. So that's really cool. The other thing that you'll see in the upper right-hand corner, you may have noticed this actually already in some of the previous builds, but this is called a provisional tab. And the idea is that for these things that you kind of open up files for something that's very contextual, like we've all been there, we're debugging code, we're stepping over, stepping in, and then all of a sudden we've got like 40 tabs open, and you got to go buy a bigger monitor just to hold everything you're working on. And then with a provisional tab, we are only going to keep this file open during the code review. And then once Cameron finishes with the code review, we'll close this file and any other files that were associated with that code review so he can get right back into what it was he was working on. Now, if he wants, he can promote this and say promote this to stay in his tab well, but by default, we'll just close that for him, which is really nice. So he can come in here and he can say, you know, let me give a comment. Regex looks good, but he notices here that we're still calling this zip code, and that's a very US-only thing. The rest of the world uses postal code, so switch this to postal code. I think it's a good suggestion, and he'll say finish, and then notice this changes, or just closes for him automatically, and he's back to whatever it is that that he was working on. So now when I come back and I refresh, I'll see that this code review is done. Notice it showed up in bold, so it kind of calls my eye to something just changed since the last time I looked at it. And then I can see that, you know, he wants me to switch this to postal code, but he's happy with these changes, so I can go ahead and submit that. And I'll fix the postal code stuff later, and we're good to go. Okay. Now, I sometimes ask for a show of hands of how many people do unit testing, but I think it embarrasses people, so I'm not going to do that. I'll admit I don't do as much unit testing as I really should. But we know that unit testing is a great way to improve the quality of your code and catch any regressions that you might have. And the problem with unit testing is that Visual Studio supports this unit testing framework called MS Test, whereas there's a lot of different unit testing frameworks that are out there, everything from XUnit to InUnit, and I'm sure you can name your favorite unit testing framework, and we could probably build a list of 20 or 30 of those. And so what we've done in this release is we've made the unit testing support in Visual Studio extensible. So out of the box, we're going to ship unit testing support for MS Test. We have a brand new unit testing adapter for C++, but we're also going to allow you to go grab unit testing adapters from third parties, and we're already working with guys like Brad Wilson, who own the XUnit adapter, and so he's going to ship that along with the beta as well, so that you can plug those into Visual Studio, or you can drop them on your build server. And the way those work is we actually just look across your entire solution for any unit tests that match the syntax that that adapter can understand. And so in this unit test explorer view, I don't care what those unit tests are. I can just say, run all those tests, and we'll just run across your solution for all of those unit tests. And so I actually have in here a mixture of InUnit and MS Test unit tests. And so they all run, they all come back. It's really nice so that if you have different people on your team that like to use different unit testing frameworks, they can. But the other really big common one that I see is, hey, I'm going to go get this open source library that we're going to start using, and who knows what unit tests ship with that. Well, now you don't have to care. You can just go grab the adapters that you need, and you're off and running. This is another dialogue that you can look forward to even more improvements in the beta, but already I love what we've done in the developer preview. One of these things that I like, for example, is the ability to quickly see why this test failed. So I get a stack trace that takes me to the exception that was thrown in my test code and the exception that was thrown in the application code as well. So I can see exactly what was happening within here. I can see the source for the code. So that's an in-unit test. You can see we're using the built-in in-unit mocking framework for some of these tests. So that's really nice. Now, beyond unit testing, there's other things that we've done in the product to help you write better quality code, and that's a new feature called Code Clone. So Code Clone is a great piece of technology that Microsoft Research has been working on for a few years. And the idea with Code Clone is that we want to help you identify sections across your solution where somebody may have copied and pasted one block of code to another section of code. Now, we don't just do a plain string search. If we did that, then you know we would miss a lot of these. So Code Clone is very smart about being able to look for semantically similar matches across your solution. So I'll just show you a really basic example of this. If I say analyze solution for code clones, it's going to look across my entire solution for any blocks of code that look similar. And for those of you in the front row, you'll probably notice that these two blocks of code are identical with the exception of the redirect action. So what probably happened here is somebody said, hey, this does what I needed to do. Let me copy and paste it over here and change that last line. That's not a great pattern, right? We should really take the opportunity to refactor that, make it some common module, and then pass that redirect action as a property to that method. The other nice thing about this, too, is that let's say that, you know, maybe this isn't a block of code that we can refactor, for example, but we do need to make a bug change. And so you can come in here and say, I'm making this bug fix here. Where else do I need to make that bug fix? And so that's a really nice opportunity for you to do that. And then the other thing that I've seen people start to use this for is let's say that, there's this this service ticket object, and I see that someone else has written some code that that assigns that service ticket object and then makes another assignment and passes it somewhere else. Well, you know, what's the best practice on our team? Should we be wrapping that in a try-catch? Do I need to do any logging or anything like that? And so what I can do is I can just write a couple of lines, and I can just grab those lines, and I can right-click and say analyze or find matching clones in the solution, and it's going to look for any clones on a much more granular basis that look similar to this section of code that I just selected. And so by default, you know, when you run this across your entire solution, we don't just want to come back and say, hey, you've initialized, you know, the variable x to 0 like 100 times. So by default, we have a very coarse granularity, and that's why you found this big block of code. But if you narrow in on a smaller block of code, oftentimes you can find some interesting things there as well and use those for either fixing bugs or learning how other people on your team use the code. Okay? So that's Code Clone. I think that's everything I want to show you in Visual Studio right now. So the next thing I want to talk about is this idea of DevOps. And so, you know, actually the one thing I will show you tomorrow is all around exploratory testing and lab management. So we've done a lot of really cool things in Microsoft Test Manager to really embrace exploratory testing, sometimes called agile testing. So in 2010, we shipped this Microsoft Test Manager product that allows you to do formal test case management, starting with the requirements and the user stories, building up your suite of test cases over time that you then run on a periodic basis. And when you run those tests, as I mentioned earlier, we can capture actionable bugs by pulling together all the information about the system under test and exactly what the tester was doing. Well, formal test case management is great, and it's a great way to make sure that you're covering all of what the requirement says that you should be doing. But oftentimes, as we know, sometimes we just want to put our tester hat on and go break stuff, and you'll find a lot of stuff that way that you wouldn't have thought to find by necessarily writing formal test cases. And so tomorrow I'll show you how the tool has been extended to support agile testing, where you just get in and, you know, start testing for a couple of hours, filing bugs as you go, and then how we blended those two approaches together so that you can have the best of both formal test case management and exploratory testing. I'm also going to show you how you can take advantage of lab management and TFS 11 as well. So lab management provides a great capability for you to set up these build, deploy, test workflows where I say make a change over here, build it, push it to that server or that set of servers, and then run these automated tests, and then let me use that environment to do some manual testing. So lab management is a capability that we shipped in 2010. The problem with that was that it would take you a lot of time to set up everything you needed to get a full end-to-end lab management environment. You needed to have Windows Server running SCVMM across multiple physical machines usually. You would have to have Hyper-V images. And it's a great technology once you can finally adopt it, but it's not something that we all have the time to become a subject matter expert around. And so it wasn't something that was approachable to everyone. And I'm going to show you tomorrow how you can start taking advantage of lab management and TFS 11 to set up your own lab managed environment in a matter of minutes. And so that's a brand new talk I've written this week. So I'm really excited to deliver that, and I hope I'll see some of you back here tomorrow, or not here, wherever my room is tomorrow. So that's, I'm just going to table from a demo perspective because there's a lot to say about that. So now let me say what we do once we pass the code over to operations. And so we've designed the right software, we've developed the right software, we were productive, we tested it, all that good stuff. But oftentimes, no matter how good of a job we do, sometimes we get bugs back from wherever this code is running in production, and they tell us that there's a server down and we need to fix it. And so, as I mentioned earlier, that conversation usually goes something like this, where the IT pro is calling you saying, hey, we've got a server down, problems in your code. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. Okay, send me a log. And so you go back and forth, and you get all this information, event logs, what build are you running, all this kind of stuff, right? Send me an IntelliTrace file. What's an IntelliTrace file? So that's a problem that we think we can do a lot to solve. And there's two major ways that we are bridging that development operations gap in this release. And the first is with a bridge between System Center Operations Manager and Team Foundation Server. And this is actually something that works with TFS 2010 or TFS 11. You don't need to have TFS 11 to take advantage of that. But the System Center team is going to be shipping as part of System Center 2012 the capability for you to, say, take this incident. So as an IT pro, I'm monitoring this collection of servers, and I see this particular server is throwing an exception. So I'm going to take that incident, and I'm going to right-click and say, turn that into a work item in TFS. And what happens behind the scenes there is we package up all that information that you as a developer would have historically had to ask for. Maybe that's an event log. We can package up AVI code data. So AVI code, if you're not familiar with that, we acquired them a few years ago. Really great always-on monitoring solution that can just track everything across C++ or .NET code from kind of a stack trace perspective. All that stuff gets packaged up automatically. As an IT pro, I don't have to call anybody. As a development support team, I can see that coming to TFS, and I can figure out exactly what I need to do. So that's a great solution if you're running SCUM in your environment. And I highly recommend checking that out. But that's not a solution for everyone. Sometimes, you know, you may not be running SCUM, or you may have applications that run outside of your environment because you're shipping stuff to customers all the time, and you're not going to go through and wire up to their SCUM environments. And so the other solution we want to enable is by bringing IntelliTrace into a production environment. Now, let me first caveat that this is not an always-on solution. So the way I like to describe it is the SCUM solution, that's like the black box in an airplane. It's always running. It has, you know, no overhead really on the application, whereas IntelliTrace is more like when you drive your car into the BMW dealership and they take the computer and they plug it in and they say, hey, we've noticed that your spark plugs are misfiring. You know, it'll be X number of euros to fix that, right? And so IntelliTrace is the same thing. So you see that there's a problem running on your production system, and then we allow you to take IntelliTrace and then start collecting data on that server so that hopefully you can reproduce the issue and then take everything back to your environment within Visual Studio and debug that, okay? And I'm going to show you a demo of that. The one final thing that we're doing here to bridge the DevOps gap is with Preemptive. So you may have seen Preemptive. They make the .fuscator product. They do a lot of really cool stuff, especially around .NET. But they have this new offering called Preemptive Analytics, and we're going to be shipping a version of that with the product, so you'll be able to get that with Visual Studio 11. And it can plug straight into Team Foundation Server 11 so that if you ship Preemptive Analytics with your applications, and so a Windows Phone application, you could ship that with your Windows Phone application or your web application, and you could say, I want you to instrument this section of the application, and they make it really easy for you to go in and say what parts of the application are interesting. From there, if your users then opt in to sending data, I'm sure you've seen this in other applications where you say, yes, I want to send Microsoft information to improve this experience. Well, your customers now can do the same thing and send that data right back to you, and all of that gets stored right within Team Foundation Server. So I'm not showing a demonstration of that today, but if that's interesting to you, Justin Marks did a talk at the ALM Summit back in November, and all of that content is online on Channel 9, and about halfway through his presentation, he shows exactly how that wires up. So you could be looking at TFS, and you can say, I see that, you know, 20% of my user base keeps hitting an exception every Friday night. Let me drill into that and understand why, and maybe it's a time zone issue, or, you know, whatever the case may be, or this is something we definitely need to apply some resources fixing. Okay? So I've done enough talking about this slide. Let me jump into a demonstration here. So my scenario here is, you know, I've got an application, it's running, it's in production, and it's my intranet application. Actually, no, let's use the customer portal. It's a little bit more interesting. And on this customer portal, I get a call because, you know, users keep clicking around, and occasionally there's this error. Retrieving data, you know, and I don't have a good way of knowing what that means. I wasn't smart to use error codes or anything like that. And so now it's up to me to try to figure out what's happening on this production server. Now, your production servers are all probably in different places around the world, or maybe they're in secure data centers, or maybe they should be in secure data centers, and you don't always have the opportunity to just say, let me run Visual Studio and attach to the process that's running over there. And so sometimes you may not even have access from that production data center back to across the network to grab your debugging tools. And so what we've done in this release is we actually will be shipping a version of IntelliTrace that actually you can just throw onto a memory stick to start doing some data collection. And so here I have a list of files that I've extracted from that memory stick, the same set of files we'll be giving you, and I can just use PowerShell to say import module and point it at that IntelliTrace DLL. And so after you do that, you can say git command, everything with IntelliTrace in it. And so now I have a number of commands that I can get access to. The one that we'll start with here is called start IntelliTrace collection. Start basically says, let me attach myself to the ASP.NET process running on a particular app pool. And so I'll say start IntelliTrace collection, give it the app pool name, give it a location where I want to capture that data, and then give it a collection plan. The collection plan basically says, you know, how much information do we want to capture running from this application. And with IntelliTrace, you have a few different options. One is I can just capture all of what's called IntelliTrace events, and you can define which individual events you want to capture, but some examples are, you know, tell me every time I access the file system. Tell me every time I throw or catch an exception. Tell me every time I get a file. You know, those are just a few events, and you can even customize that and create your own events for applications that make sense for you. But now what I've done is I've started collecting IntelliTrace data on this particular app pool. And so the way that works behind the scenes is when we next, you know, initiate this ASP.NET request, it's going to rejit that application, and it's going to rewrite that MSIL so that we're actually inserting all of that trace information into your application. So again, there is a little bit of overhead. First is going to be the startup cost here. Additionally, we're collecting a lot of data behind the scenes. So there is going to be a performance degradation while you're running IntelliTrace. But the idea is that you're only going to be running this usually for a short period of time so you can capture that information and then ship that over to Visual Studio where you can analyze it. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, would you have to run this on every web server that you have in the farm? And so, yes, if you thought that this was the result of some code that was running on a specific web server, you would want to start this process on every server because it's only going to be able to collect on that specific machine. In the future, I think we can do some interesting things for you to make it easier to run across web farms. But right now, yes, you would have to manually collect it on those servers. And so now, I've recycled my web application. Let me just run this application until I hit the error again. And so I've hit that error. So I'm reasonably confident that I have the data I need. If I wasn't, I could say what's called checkpoint. And when you checkpoint, that's just going to output a file for you that you can import into Visual Studio, but it's going to keep collecting the data. So now I have a file. This is just an IntelliTrace file. I'm going to open that up into Visual Studio. One important thing to keep in mind here is that if you plan to use this, make sure that when you set up your team builds, that you are going into team build and you're choosing the option to archive symbols, because that's what's going to allow you to match up the IntelliTrace file, which may represent code that you built 3 weeks ago, match that up with the version of code that you have stored in Team Foundation Server from 3 weeks ago. And so here you can see that we've got all the threads that are running as part of this process. One of the things we've added to IntelliTrace, for those of you that are familiar with it from 2010, is we've taken all the web performance requests and we've logged those in here as well. So it's kind of a blend of not only the exceptions and everything, but also the performance data, what requests took the longest, that sort of thing. And so that's really nice. And then as we get down the list, we can see a list of all of our exceptions. And so there I can see a null reference exception. I can drill into that. This is going to open up a list of all of the IntelliTrace events that I have. And so over on the right-hand side, these are all the IntelliTrace events. And this is a chronological list. So towards the top, you can see that we have a lot of ASP.NET gets where we're getting specific files, and I could drill into one of those events to understand what's going on. And then as we get down to this particular record, when I clicked that exception, it takes me straight to the line of code that ran when that exception was generated. And then if I look at locals, we actually see the state of all the variables that are a part of that method call. So there you can see it's null. And if I wanted to spend the time stepping back to see how we got to be null in the first place, I could do that. But that's IntelliTrace. And so you can capture all those events, and you can also capture at the verbose level, you can capture all of the values that you pass into a method and all the values you get back as well. So you can really kind of turn this thing up to 11 and get a lot of data there. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so great question. So his question was, I just showed a web application. Can you use it for WPF or Windows Forms? We've kind of optimized the scenario around web applications, but yes, you can use it for other applications as well. And basically the way that you do that, I can't remember the command line syntax, but it's something to do with running IntelliTrace.exe and then passing the name of the process that you're going to be collecting. And so what we do then is we start the application, and then we're doing the same thing. We're capturing all that data to some location that you can then export somewhere else. The other thing that we want to make it really easy for you to do if you want is you can actually ship IntelliTrace with your application, and it's free to collect. We're not going to charge your end user to collect the data. The way that we monetize this is you need to have the appropriate Visual Studio license to analyze it. But you can ship this with your application so that when you get a call from your user in the middle of the night who says, hey, I've got an issue, you can say, maybe even program a restart function right into your web application or your WinForms application, say, help analyze with IntelliTrace, and that'll restart the application, say, hey, reproduce that issue, and then you could even write some more code that says automatically send that, you know, over the wire to your TFS server or to an FTP site or something like that. So we're making all the licensing available for you to do all of those scenarios, and I think it'll be really interesting to see what people come back and do with it. So I have 3 minutes. Let me just talk about one more thing here, which is the Team Foundation service. So a lot of people are familiar with Team Foundation server that runs on-premises. Well, about a year ago, we started taking Team Foundation server and trying to see what that would look like as a service hosted on top of the Windows Azure platform. And so I've actually been working with a number of early adopters who are already using the Team Foundation service in production for all of their day-to-day application lifecycle management needs. For the most part, it's the same thing that you would get with Team Foundation server on-premises. There's a couple of things we don't support yet, like the SharePoint integration and the data warehouse reporting, just because some of those capabilities don't exist kind of at the core Azure platform level. So if you need those things, you should still use Team Foundation server on-premises. But everyone in this room can go to tfspreview.com, and you can sign up for your own Team Foundation service preview account. It does ask you for a code, but if you go to the waiting list, you can add yourself to the waiting list, and I think we're processing people in just a matter of about just a few days. So we'll get back to you and with a code that you can use to sign up. It's free right now. Once we announce pricing, we'll give you a certain period of time to decide if you want to export your data or start paying for the service. But I think you'll really like it. It actually includes all of those web dashboards that I showed earlier. So if you want to set up your product backlog and start managing your sprints and your capacity and your task board, all that's built in. And, of course, all the core capabilities around things like source control and work items are there. So that's it. I think I've got 1 minute for maybe just a couple of questions. Yeah?
You showed the workspaces, new system. How do you set them up?
How do you set up the workspaces, the new local workspaces? By default, in TFS 11, working with a Visual Studio 11 client, any workspace you set up is by default going to be a local workspace. You can choose to use the more traditional workspace if you want to, but I haven't seen a good reason to do that. So just out of the box, you'll get those local workspaces.
Well, what I mean is if I have a new development project, and I mean, normally I would add it to source control, but I guess that would be a little bit different.
Well, what you would do, so he's talking about a brand new development project. What you would do is you would just create a new branch or a new folder within Team Foundation Server. You would say map that back to my local drive, so C:\ my cool new project. And then anytime you made changes over there using Emacs or Notepad or whatever, you would go back to pending changes. It would say, hey, here's all the new files and the file edits. You just check those in, and those are going
to
show up in source control.
Yes,
it's the same way you're used to setting up workspace mappings today. Exactly. I think there's another one over here. Yep.
Can you make code review required?
No, you can't make a code review required. You can go back and do audits later on to say, you know, did anyone check in files that didn't go through a code review? Because the code review, since it's a work item, it does get linked up to any of your change sets when you're checking in. So we don't try to block you from doing that. But what I would recommend there is just as part of your merging strategy, as you're promoting code from one branch to another, you do an audit, make sure everything was reviewed, and if it wasn't, then you go back and, you know, yell at the developer or whatever. So I'm sorry I'm out of time. I will stick around for the other questions, so let's chat afterwards. But thank you so much, and I hope to see some of you tomorrow. Thank you.